This is an ABC podcast.
I'm Jonathan Green. You're listening to Lost and Found, and this week we're off to visit our friends across the Tasman in the New Zealand bubble. At least we'll get to eventually. If you've never had the chance to visit the land of the long white cloud, perhaps this is your chance. So to get you off on the right foot, here are a couple of ideas. And in a couple of months' time, with luck, lockdowns permitting, you will be on your way. Consider this your starter pack for a trip to Aotearoa. If you're a camper, a glamper, a hiker, or a bushwalker, well, here's something new to try. Tramping.
Well, tramping, I guess, is the equivalent of bushwalking, but it seems to be a bit more rough around the edges, I suppose.
Herb Christophers, an experienced tramper of over 50 years, now working at New Zealand's Department of Conservation.
Hiking doesn't quite cut the mustard either, because hiking tends to be on more manicured tracks. And we've got our fair share of at both ends of the spectrum. Over here, the Department of Conservation's got more than 950 huts and thousands of kilometres of tracks, and not all of them are 2 metres wide and groomed and graded and bench track. There's some fairly rough areas as well, of course, as you can imagine, with the Southern Alps going up to 12,000 feet, or 3,500 metres.
For the Australian walker, they would find much that's beautiful and unique in New Zealand's environment.
I suppose you could divide New Zealand into two different categories. You've got the North Island and the South Island, and the South Island is, I guess, the better known of the two, because it's got the Southern Alps, which are quite dramatic, absolutely stunning, and there's lots of tracks throughout there, and there's stories told of early explorers throughout that whole area. The North Island is more, we'd call it undulating, but I guess you guys would call it pretty damn close. Some of our hills are pretty steep in the North Island, and it's more dissected country, more chopped up and more heavily forested, and a different type of forest, temperate rainforest. So it's a different sort of area. But yeah, totally different. The Australians who come over here always seem to love it.
It's almost a place sort of made for tramping.
Yeah, well, in more recent years, somebody said, look, we've got to put a track in from North Cape to Bluff, and then, now we have this thing called Te Araroa, which in Maori means the long way, the long pathway. And that's what people are coming to do more and more, which is relatively accessible. Sort of tramping makes it more accessible for a lot more people. But on the side of that, you've got your stuff which borders on mountaineering, and the other stuff which is a nice coastal walk. So, yeah, there's a huge range.
Is there anything that the Australian walker, will they be prepared for walking in New Zealand? Are there any variations in sort of clothing or kit that they should bear in mind?
Yes, it's a case of layering. You've got to come prepared with layers. I always go down to four layers: a light layer to wear next to the skin, usually warm and light, and then another layer to keep extra warm if it gets colder, and take off if it gets too warm. Another layer to block the weather, and that would be your waterproof, and then something to wear around when you're recreating, when you sort of stop walking for the day. So that's four layers. If you have to put four layers on, you have to question as to whether or not you should be out in that sort of weather.
Look, we could have pointed you towards all the obvious spots: a tour of the Beehive, that's New Zealand's Parliament House, or going all the way to the top of Auckland's Sky Tower. Perhaps a day trip to Lyttelton, sleepy beach town on the edge of Christchurch. But no, too obvious. But let's go further than just the capital cities. Guy Williams, host of New Zealand Today, has agreed to take us to two of his favourite small towns. Guy, where to first?
Opononi is a town in New Zealand that everyone in New Zealand kind of knows about for a bizarre feat, and that is they had a magic dolphin. They wrote a song about it. It was covered by documentarians. For about 2 months, Opononi had a dolphin that would swim around the harbour doing tricks, flicking beer bottles to punters. He would play with kids in the sea. he was an absolute icon. They love him so much there. Every store in Opinoni is named after they call the dolphin after the town. It's called Oppo, the magic dolphin, and they've got a statue. The fish and chip store has got an Oppo burger. They've got a grave for the dolphin, literally in the town square. And what was weird is that I went to Opinoni to try and investigate what happened to the dolphin, because it had only been famous in New Zealand for about 2 months before it mysteriously passed away.
And
it turns out the locals, and this is not confirmed, like I'm not a professional journalist, I'm a comedian, so I don't know for sure, but most of the locals who spoke to me off record claim that it was due to dynamite fishing. They blew up their own magic dolphin. It's a sad, sad story where this town became famous for 2 months because of having a magic dolphin, and then 2 months later, they accidentally blew it up with dynamite while doing dynamite fishing. It's bizarre.
Probably
and hilarious. It
probably explains the abundance of Oppo burgers subsequently.
Yeah, it definitely does that. But for any Australians wanting for a lovely off the beaten track place to visit in New Zealand, the far north of New Zealand is amazing. Opinoni is the closest town to Tane Mahuta, one of our most famous and sacred trees. And Opinoni is just a beautiful place, and it's cool to go to a town that's built its whole city about around a dolphin that was only there for about 2 months. It's funny and awesome.
Upon landing in New Zealand, you'll likely encounter some new words. Kia ora, or hello. Aroha, meaning love. Pakeha, that's the word for European New Zealanders. Kai means food. That's an important one, write that down. Oh, yes, puku. Stomach, that's where the kai goes. Many Australians may not realise that New Zealand has three official languages. Tell us about that.
Yes, well, the most recent addition to the three is the deaf language, acknowledging the significant number of people with hearing impairments in New Zealand.
Ella Henry, inaugural director of Māori Advancement at Auckland University of Technology, renowned for her research into the advocacy of Māori culture, language and leadership.
And Māori has been an official language. It was one of the outcomes of a claim to the Waitangi Tribunal in the early 1990s, which acknowledged that the government had done very little to protect the Māori language, which was deemed to be one of the taonga, or precious things, that the Crown agreed to protect and nurture under the Treaty of Waitangi. So one of the consequences of that treaty claim was the setting up of a Māori language commission on the one hand, and the acknowledgement of the Māori language as an indigenous language to this country.
So what has happened in the intervening period? What are the differences now in day-to-day New Zealand life between now and that moment when Māori language is recognised so formally?
Well, even though we've only had it recognised as a formal language for 30 years or so, the reality is the Māori language has permeated New Zealand life since the first contact, really. I mean, most New Zealanders who are very comfortable calling themselves Kiwi often forget that is a Māori word. Hmm. The haka has been performed by our rugby team for generations, and that is a Māori language and cultural practice that, you know, we have used in traditional times before going into some kind of fraught situation, battle, competition. So in many ways, Māori has been, language and culture have been part of the New Zealand identity for a long time. However, the government has done nothing to protect or promote that until it recently, you know, in the last 30 or 40 years, and in fact, actively dissuaded the use of the Māori language right from the end of the 19th century up until the mid-20th century. So, sorry, that's a long answer to what was a very short question. Māori language and culture have been a part of the landscape in this country for a very long time, but as a governmental responsibility in terms of the Treaty of Waitangi, since the 1990s, we've seen a prolific growth in the availability of resources, in the bilingual or the adoption of bilingual names and signage of government departments, educational facilities, funding set aside for education, and of course, the growth of the Māori language education system, which came about very much out of Māori community efforts in the 1980s, but was formalised in the 1990s, and now allows early child care right up to university education entirely in the Māori language. And that, of course, that combination of factors has really, I think, encouraged more common usage, particularly by non-Māori and particularly in the media.
Is the language universal across New Zealand?
Well, there are small dialectical differences. I mean, it's certainly not the same case as in Australia, where your Aboriginal peoples have developed their languages over thousands of years, and they can be significantly different from one tribal group to another around the vast nation that is Australia. In New Zealand, our language is common to the whole of the Polynesian diaspora, so I can go to Tahiti and Hawaii, to Easter Island and Rarotonga, and I can understand a significant amount of their language. Then within New Zealand over a thousand years, obviously they've become dialectic or dialect differences amongst the different tribal groups. But it is a language that actually traverses a huge part of the planet, if you think about all of the people of Polynesia sharing a common language origin.
And that, that biculturalism in New Zealand, just those simple things like bilingual signage, for example. I mean, some people dismiss that sort of thing as a tokenistic gesture. How do you see it?
Well, I mean, my view is people who have that view probably don't agree with the process that's been going on for the last many years. What is really interesting, though, is that often New Zealanders who are not Māori, but who are familiar with some aspects of Māori language and culture, often don't realise that it is as much a part of their identity as their non-Māori culture, and they do that when they travel. And you will find, you'll go to England and you'll see New Zealanders of European descent, or Pākehā as we call them, in London and Paris and New York, you know, who are happily using Māori language and saying kia ora, and, you know, having a large greenstone pōnamu to denote that this is something unique and distinctive about us as a nation, regardless of whether we are Māori or not.
Some more helpful Australia to New Zealand English translations. The milk bar is called the dairy. Eskies are called chili bins or chili buns. A house is often referred to as a flat. Thongs for your feet are called jandals. Probably quite sensible, as thong is somewhat ambiguous. In fact, new rule, don't refer to your thong collection in public if you can help it. Have we reached that point in New Zealand culture where the culture is truly a hybrid of those points of origin?
I'd like to think that that's been happening for generations, that quite apart from anything else, you know, the numbers of people with some Māori descent, we don't use blood quantum to describe ourselves. You could have a very tiny amount of Māori actual blood quantum, but if you are proud to call yourself a Māori, if you know about your tribal identity, if you understand your language, we embrace that as part of Māori population, Māori demographics, and more importantly, that mix and meld of Māori and non-Māori has actually, I think, created a very interesting and innovative New Zealand population.
All right, if you were to take us, if you can make the choice to three of your favourite outdoor places in New Zealand, where to begin?
The place I'd go to in the North Island is the active volcanoes in the Tongariro National Park. Now, this is one of the areas which is, well, was established in a national park as early as 1887, but it's got a lot of things going for me. It's the place I first went tramping when I was a schoolboy in the late 60s, and then later on it became a hub for where I learned to ski. So there's tramping and there's skiing, and there's now a great walk around there, so you can do what's called the Tongariro Northern Circuit, which is a 3 or 4 day tramp. Now, that's really good because you don't actually have to climb the mountains. You just go in and out and weave in the way around them. You don't actually have to get involved in climbing the mountains, which is just fantastic. So you're surrounded by these active volcanoes and you've got this wild open grassland, which is subject to a lot of snow in the winter, but, you know, fantastic vistas in the summer. It's a beautiful place. Open grasslands, wonderful place.
Guy, take us to Granity.
Granity is one of the most special places you can go to in New Zealand. I would recommend it because of the scenic beauty.
Guy Williams, comedian and host of New Zealand Today.
But also because of its bizarre story. It's a coal mining town right on the coast of the west coast of the South Island, and it's falling into the sea. Basically, coastal erosion, natural coastal erosion exacerbated by climate change, is washing houses literally into the ocean, and it's kind of sad. And it's kind of interesting to me because their council, their own city council, doesn't actually acknowledge or believe in climate change. It's a coal mining town, and it's run by coal miners. So as a result, you've got this bizarre situation where climate change is literally destroying one of their towns, and the people who are supposed to be fixing the situation don't believe it's a problem. It's kind of hilarious and bleak at the same time.
How do the people of Granity rationalise this situation?
Well, they are all from a different pace of life. I love small town New Zealand. Granity has probably about 180 people, and it's just in another world. Everyone's an artist there. No one is particularly good at it, but they're all trying their best. They have a judo club. They have a radio station. 180 people have their own radio station. It's kind of amazing. And it's a punk rock radio station, which is hilarious because that seems quite niche to me. So basically, I think the guy running it is basically playing it to his partner, is basically what it is, the way I see it. They run off CDs though. So if you're there, please bring your CDs because of the cyclone that hit their town, the roof of the radio station actually blew off. And when they put the CDs out on the street to dry them out, someone stole all their CDs. So if you've got any punk rock radio CDs and you're going to the west coast of the South Island, please bring Bedrock FM some CDs because they need them desperately.
How many have they got left? This reminds me of the famous Goodies episode of the pirate radio station that the Goodies set up with only one record, A Walk in the Black Forest.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I sometimes think New Zealand, that just as a country, we're just a joke country, really, aren't we? Whenever we make New Zealand international news, it's always for some bizarre story about we threw a sex toy at a Minister of Finance a few years ago. We changed our flag to the same flag after a multi-million dollar referendum. We're a joke country. And I just couldn't help when I went to Granity, even though it was tragic that these people were being horrifically affected by cyclones and climate change, there was something darkly funny about the fact that they had a radio station and the roof blew off and their CDs got stolen. And then I went to the local theatre group, the Granity Players, and they had the exact same problem. They had a theatre, they were doing great shows, and their roof blew off too. And I don't know what's going on in Granity and why they can't staple their roofs down properly, but they've had multiple local institutions destroyed by the roof literally blowing off. It sounds like a John Clark sketch.
And then the roof blew off.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly that. And it just happens in New Zealand. This is New Zealand. This is how we live our lives. We're strange people.
Herb, where to next?
Well, okay, let's jump islands and go down to the South Island. And we're looking really around what I would call the Queenstown Lakes District. So Queenstown, as you're probably aware, is a fairly major tourist hub. But if you just get out of that tourist mecca, outside of that there's a small town called Wanaka, which is getting a bit touristy, but the valleys from there, glaciated river valleys, you know, you can imagine that millions of years ago, the glaciers ripped down these areas and then retreated and left these wonderful open valleys. And they're just beautiful for walking, and there's short walks for day trips. There's longer walks into the steeper part of the hills, and there's something there for everybody. There's Cadrona ski field for the skiers, and there's the Matukituki Valley, which is one of the ones that comes into Lake Wanaka. Just brilliant. If you're going to hang around Queenstown itself, there's a thing called Moke Lake, which is a small, short walk, which if you're having a day off and you just want to go for a short walk, that's really fantastic. You can even do a bit of mountain biking in there. And that's one thing I've noticed, you know, we're changing the way the way that we cater for people with different tastes. Mm. Things have evolved from people just walking in the hills, and now we're finding that a lot of our tramping tracks, our bushwalking tracks, are becoming popular cycle tracks, and we're catering for that sort of thing as well. So, you know, what used to take us a couple of days to do can be knocked out in half a day on a mountain bike.
I wonder what the view is of Australia's relationship with Indigenous culture from across the Tasman, because I think the sense we have here is that we lag what you are doing in combining those cultures.
Well, I mean, I think I'm very fortunate in that I have a wide circle of Aboriginal Australian colleagues and friends.
Ella Henry.
And I know that they are certainly actively engaged in scholarship and in revitalization of their own language and culture and identity. And I'm certainly heartened to see increasing numbers of non-Aboriginal Australians who are acknowledging country, are familiar with the name of the tribal communities in their area, are acknowledging the elders when they are, you know, engaging in new projects. So whilst on the outside it may seem, I don't know, that there might be a lag between Australia and New Zealand, the reality is both of our nations are on a journey. It doesn't really matter which bus stop we happen to be. And the journey is about demarcating our unique and distinctive identity as new world countries that are melding the old and the new and innovative ways.
For Australians and New Zealanders right now in these strange COVID times, we are both the world. This is the places that we could travel to. If I'm an Australian visitor wanting to know more and to engage with Maori culture, what should I do? Where should I go?
Well, I mean, obviously the best way to get to know us is by having some kind of kinship or whānau connection, if you know people who know people. And at the end of the day, even our two nations are still quite small by global population comparisons. I've no doubt that very many Australians might know somebody. We call them Mozzies, by the way, Māori Australians. So you don't just have mosquito infestations, you have Mozzies all over the place as well. They've infiltrated your sports teams, your music world, and are creating new generations of interesting Australian and New Zealand collaborations. So obviously, if you're lucky, if you're fortunate and you know somebody over here, you would make connections with them. But the museums, particularly in Auckland and Wellington, are a wonderful place to start. And many of the tribal communities in the larger areas are running tours and offering opportunities to go to the local community marae, as we call it, the community centre. So there are, if you are open to having a cultural experience when you come and visit my country, it's not that difficult.
All right, last stop. Where shall we round off our tramping trip?
If you just head a bit further south, Queenstown Lakes, you end up in basically what is the corner of Fiordland near Te Anau.
Herb Christophers.
Te Anau is a small town which gives you access to places like the Kepler, which is one of our great walks, and at the right time of the year, the Milford Track as well. You can do bookings online, by the way. They're still open right now, so if anybody just want to come over, as long as you've got the right bubble to come over in, there's plenty of opportunities to go. Tramping, walking, bushwalking in some of our great walks. And then, you know, I know that was my third one, but I'm really going to slip another one in.
You should.
This is like taking you from the mountains to the sea. Coromandel Peninsula. We're back in the North Island. The Coromandel Peninsula is one of those places where the trees come down to the beach, and it's a forest called Pahutukawa, which is a tree that is distantly related to your gum trees. And it's our New Zealand Christmas tree. It's got bright red flowers that come out at Christmas time. And the thing about the Coromandel Peninsula, it's got long beaches that are accessible so that you don't have to be doing too much hard walking, but there's lots of little day trips that go up into the steep interior where there's the old volcanic plugs from millions of years ago that formed the whole peninsula in the first place. So, you know, warm sun, outdoor opportunities on the water, just fantastic.
You've been listening to Lost and Found this week in the New Zealand bubble. You heard from Guy Williams, Herb Christophers and Ella Henry. For more Lost and Found journeys to New Zealand destinations, check out our episodes on Christchurch and South Auckland on the ABC Listen app or the Blueprint page on the RN website. Producers are Lisa DeVisi and Alan Whedon. Technical production by Brendan O'Neill. I'm Jonathan Green.
Fun, don't you? And living with you is a ball of a time. Hey.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listener.